giving you a quiz. You don't have to answer out loud, so don't be embarrassed. I'm going to ask you a set of questions, a set of alternatives. Just quietly to yourself. Don't let anybody look at your answers. Just note your thoughts, your immediate thoughts. So the first question, I'm sorry, do you think you could move the boots off there? It's sort of, from a Buddhist point of view, we never put shoes on the shrine. Thank you, yeah. The first question is the world, the universe, infinite or finite in terms of space? Is there a point where the universe ends, and I suppose, therefore, another point where it ends over there, or not? Yeah? Just note your answer. Of course, then, we're dealing with space there. I was going to write this all out, but you're probably intelligent enough to hold it in your minds. The second question is, of course, is the universe infinite in time or not? Was there a beginning and will there be an end or not? Yeah? Is it eternal, you could say, or is it temporarily finite? No doubt some of you are pretty sophisticated and already got quantum physics on the go and all that. But just see what your response is to those two questions. The third perhaps tickles the fancy of the neurologists and psychologists and so forth. But is the let's say mind, it's not really quite the right word in this context, but let's for the time being say mind, the same as the body or not? Is the body, are the body and mind identical or are they different? Answers just keep to yourself in the privacy of your own brain. The fourth question is much more difficult because it already implies a certain amount of knowledge of Buddhism. But I'll ask it anyway. The Buddha we know is supposed to have gained enlightenment, Bodhi, and he lived and walked upon this earth for many years after his enlightenment, but eventually he died, probably in his 80s. So the question is, what happened to him after he died? Did he exist after he died? Did he not exist after he died? And just in case you think the question is not already simple enough, did he both exist and not exist after he died? Or did he neither exist nor not exist after he died? That's just a little bit of garnish on the meal. So those are your four questions. Is the universe spatially finite or infinite? Is it temporally finite or infinite? Is the mind identical with the body or is it different? And does the Buddha exist after death or not, or both, or neither? The quadrilemma, it's called, how they managed to get a Greek term for an Indian logical system, I don't know. So I'm sure that everybody's got some response to all those questions, and probably given that many of you are probably quite educated and maybe studied, you'll have responses from the point of view of science, from the point of view of philosophy, and so on. These questions were put to the Buddha 2,500 years and more ago. He was approached by a wanderer who went by the name of Vachagotha, or in Sanskrit, Vachagotra. Gotra means clan, and Vacha was one particular clan. So really his name was Vachasan, or O Vacha, or Mac Thatcher, depending which part of these islands he came from, or Up Thatcher, indeed, if he came from Wales. We're given nothing more than his surname, if you like. But he crops up again and again in the Buddhist scriptures, and he's clearly of a very thoughtful mind. And he questions the Buddha again and again and again. And you can sort of trace almost an intellectual history or spiritual history of Vajragupta when you look at all the discourses in which he appears. Because gradually the penny is dropping. He's gradually getting it. And he starts off by addressing the Buddha as Bo Gotama. Bo is a sort of rather slightly over-familiar but reasonably honorific way of talking to somebody. I don't know what our equivalent would be, because we don't have any of these formalities left anymore. It's just hi and there we go. I suppose it'd be Mr. Gotama. But as the process continues over over many years, apparently he ended up, of course, going for refuge to the Buddha, becoming a bhikshu, a monk, and gaining enlightenment, becoming an arahant. Anyway, very early on in his inquiry, he came across the Buddha and asked him these four questions. He was, as I say, a wanderer. India at that time supported a large class of mendicants, people who wandered from many different points of view, if you like, religious and philosophical, or nothing. The belief system of the time suggested that if you supported such people, you got benefit. So a quite large class of mendicant mendicant men and women wandered in the jungle, came to the towns and villages, begged for food, and moved on. Some of them seem to have been absolute wastrels, from what you see in the scriptures. Some of them were highly committed to a particular point of view, and some of them were clearly on a quest. And Vajragupta was of this kind. He was on a quest. And as I say, he had quite a sophisticated inquiry. So he comes to the Buddha and he asks him these questions, and boy, does he get a strange answer. Because the Buddha says to him, when he asks, is the world infinite? He says, I don't say that. And he said, well, is it finite? He said, I don't say that either. Poor Vajragupta, you feel really sorry for him. The Buddha's, in a certain sort of way, refusing to accept the horns of the dilemma upon which Vajragupta is trying to impale him, upon which we're all impaled. If the world is not infinite, it must be finite. If it's not finite, it must be infinite. The Buddha says, no, neither of those apply. The same is the world finite in terms of time or not. Again, the Buddha says, neither of those apply. I do not say either of these. And then is I called it mind earlier, the word in Pali is jiva or jivang, which means really something more like life force. Jiva in modern Indian languages, North Indian languages, means life. It here in Buddhist scriptures often means the sort of vital element within one, that which makes one alive, that which animates. So mind is a fairly good paraphrase in terms of our own experience. Perhaps it doesn't matter too much. It's usually translated as soul, but that, frankly, is too tendentious and takes us into particular religious views. But is the living experience, being alive, the sense of being alive, the same as the body or not? Again, the Buddha says, sorry, I don't buy either of those alternatives. Poor Vajragupta by this time. The scriptures are very, very spare But one imagines, I can't help imagining by this time, that Vatragotta, if he has any hair, and he was a wanderer, so he probably cut it off, is tearing it out. Come on, man, you know, it's got to be one or the other. But the Buddha just won't accept either. He puts it in terms of, I do not say so. I do not say so. So again, for these four alternatives for whether the Buddha exists after death or not, again, he just won't accept any of them. It's not that the Buddha exists after death, or he does not say that the Buddha exists after death. He does not say that the Buddha does not exist after death. He doesn't say that the Buddha both exists and doesn't exist, because that could be a good answer, if you see what I mean. Well, you know, from a certain point of view, he exists, and from another point of view, he doesn't. No, I don't accept either of those, or I don't accept that. And I certainly don't accept that he neither exists, what's the other thing, nor doesn't exist. I've got tripped up on my own triple negatives. So Vatragotta says, come on, you know, you've got to accept one or other of these. Why do you not accept them? So the Buddha says, they are all, the word is drishti or ditti in Pali. They are all what's usually translated as speculative opinions. They're all theories. They're not just theories. They're a thicket of theories, a wasteland of theories, a tangle of theories, a desert of theories. In other words, he's not very keen on them. Therefore, I can't accept any of them. So we need to pause a little moment to just understand what we mean by a ditti or drishti, therefore view or speculative opinion. The word drishti comes from a root meaning to see. Again, you get it in modern Indian languages. Darshana Shastra means philosophy in modern Indian languages. It's interesting, I've just been with Roma people in northern Hungary, some of whom speak a language that's very similar, for instance, to modern Hindi, Gujarati, and so forth. And they have a word that corresponds to drishti. So it just means seeing. But clearly here, it's not seeing in the literal sense. If you like, it's a point of view. You know, I'm looking here at you, and you're looking there at me. So I'm looking from a point of view, you're looking from another point of view. If I go up on the ceiling and look down on you, I'll have a different point of view. So it comes to mean a sort of orientation of interpretation, a way of seeing things from a particular point of view, not merely in a spatio-temporal sense, but in an interpretive sense. If I was a Marxist-Leninist, I'd look out over this room and see the whole lot of bourgeois, etc. If I was of a theistic nature, I'd see a whole lot of people on the way to hell, etc. If I was a thoroughgoing materialist, I'd see a whole lot of people just really wasting their time in idle speculations, and so on. Of course, we don't see it like that. But actually, all the time, we see things from a certain point of view. We interpret our experience. And our interpretation is built upon our experience, if you see what I mean. So when I talk about, is the world finite or infinite, what I'm doing is taking my experience of endings, if you see what I mean. So in spatial terms, I'm taking my experience of going to the door there and coming to the end of this room and going out. when I'm talking temporally, I'm talking about my experience of, for instance, which is no doubt something you're looking forward to, this talk ending, if you see what I mean. You experience boundaries, you experience ends in space and time, which is useful, particularly if you want to get out, if you want to see what to do next. It sort of works. Of course, we're later going to have to rather deconstruct this. But we do have an experience of things ending spatially and things ending temporally. But a speculative view is built upon that. So we start to speculate about time and space themselves as if space was a room and as if time was an interval between a beginning and an end, if you see what I mean. So we extrapolate from our rather more immediate experience, it's not absolutely immediate experience, but our common sense construction of time, we construct a larger notion about space and time themselves. Actually, you never experience space. You never experience the world. You never experience time. You experience duration of one element against another. You experience the relationship of one thing to another. But you never experience space itself or time itself. So you're applying to space and time something that's derived from your experience within space and time, if you see what I mean. The Kantians amongst you will immediately have recognised some of his discussion of the antinomies of reason. He explores exactly the same area, and some have said the discourse with Vajragotta is the sort of point at which Western philosophy and Buddhism really begin to meet, be that as it may. I hope you've understood what I'm saying, that the speculative view takes from our immediate experience and applies it to the very container of our experience, as if it was something within experience. Kant described this as having ideas that are too big for our mind. Didn't exactly use those words. So we take something from within our experience and we apply it to the whole of experience. And what it does, Kant explored this extensively, is it leads to implicit contradictions. I'm not going to do this now because I just don't have time. Actually, I'm not quite clever enough. But if you begin to assert either of these oppositions, later Buddhism does explore this, you find that they don't work. And of course, in modern physics, both time and space are explored to their limits. And again, I'm only quoting what I've been told by people who know much more than me, like Jnanavacha, quantum physics really begins to explode the common sense notions of space and time and shows that in order to make them work, you have to build models that are really contrary to common sense, like multiple universes and many dimensions and so forth, which really are quite unthinkable. They're only highly abstract extrapolations. So a speculative view is a view that's derived from our ordinary common sense experience and exploded way beyond its capacity to yield unproblematic truth, if you see what I mean. So the Buddha said that space and time themselves, if thought of as wholes, lead to problems. He didn't describe what he meant by that. He simply said these are speculative views. He wasn't at this point particularly interested in proving or disproving it. Later Buddhism becomes more interested in in taking us through the thinking that shows why this is the case. We may be able to get into this a bit later. He simply said, thinking in those terms, in terms of space as a thing, so to speak, that can therefore be infinite or finite, is going way beyond your intellectual remit. It's going way beyond what thinking can do. And the same with time. That's the same with the jiva, the life force, the sense of being alive, and the body. And he again argues that to speculate about their relationship is to accept naively a distinction between them, if you see what I mean. Which isn't to say that they're not different. Because the way I think of this is that we have an experience of the body through our own senses. I can touch my body, I can see my body, I can feel my body in movement. So I have a sort of external experience of my body, if you see what I mean. In a way, the same way as I have an external experience of your bodies. But I also have an internal experience of my body. I have an experience of being embodied. I have an experience of being alive. But when I separate out these two kinds of experience, I have a problem of how to relate them. And that problem is a problem in thought, and therefore has to be resolved in thought. And when it's resolved in thought, it leads simply to further problems. It's a speculative opinion. The final problem that he was posed by Vajragatha that he said any answer to was a speculative one, was what happened to the Buddha, especially after death. Of course, it's significant that he's talking about what happened to the Buddha after death, because the Buddha would have asserted that for anybody else, well, another life would arise. That after death there would be a re-becoming, again becoming. Punabhava is the Buddhist phrase for this, not reincarnation, because that literally means something is inserted again into flesh. Kane, flesh. That's not the Buddhist perspective, that there's something that comes out of the body and then goes back into another body. It's that independence on one life, another life arises, not to put too fine a point upon it. So the significance of Vajragatha's question is that in the case of the Buddha, there is no again becoming. That's clear. The Buddha made that quite clear. There's no again becoming. So what happens? What happens when somebody gives up all clinging, understands the nature of reality as it is, and dies? The Buddha simply says, you can't think about it. You can't provide a satisfactory answer in thought. Any of the thoughts that you give to what happens will be wrong. They'll be one-sided. They'll only get part of it. They won't get the whole thing. Poor Vajragatha. One feels really sorry for him. He has another go, and he says, yeah, but what about are you saying that anybody, not just the Buddha, who gains liberation, who gains Bodhi, who awakens, you can't say what happens to him when he dies? So the Buddha said, yes, I'm not saying that he exists after death. I'm not saying that he doesn't exist after death. I'm not saying that he both exists and doesn't exist, nor am I saying that he neither exists nor doesn't exist. Got it. He's saying that none of these catch what's going on. Well, why? What's he getting at? Why can't he answer? For goodness sake, these are straightforward questions. Does it go on forever or does it stop? Has it been going on since the beginningless time, or was there a starting point? and so on. You know, either the mind is located in the body, or the body in the mind, or not, or they're separate, or you know, either the Buddha exists after death or doesn't exist, or maybe there's some sort of rather subtle blending of the two, or not. But the Buddha says all of these are speculative opinions built out of the abstraction from our direct experience. We take our direct experience, we break it up into manageable bites, concepts, which allow us to manipulate our experience. Very, very useful. Without them, I would be dumb, and you would be deaf. I'd have nothing to say, you'd have nothing to understand. So we extrapolate from our direct sensory experience concepts which are make our experience portable, if you see what I mean. We transport our experience in generalizations, abstractions, that we can then build conceptual structures out of, that enable us to remember what we happened in the past, plan for the future, and communicate with each other. All that I've said so far is based upon abstractions, words, concepts underlying the words, that are derived from direct experience, and that, if I'm doing my job properly, ultimately refer back to direct experience. But they're abstractions. They're already a movement away. Even a notion like table is a movement away from the direct experience of this, well, I was going to say object, but even object is a highly abstract term, of this. Whether you can see it or not, there's a table here. But you see, you know what I mean, because you've transported the notion of table and it's got some sort of portability that you can then reapply, which is great, it's fine, as long as you know what you're doing, as long as you know that you're taking direct experience, abstracting it for particular purposes, and then reading it back into direct experience. You know, so I can time this talk, I'm not very good at it actually, but I can work out how long I need to speak from, because I've abstracted the notion of an hour, a unit of time, and I'm measuring what I'm saying against that. But it's an abstraction. What actually is happening is right now. I'm able to sustain an argument, more or less, because I'm able to transport what I've already said, apply it in the present, and carry it forward into the future. You're able to understand me to the degree that you can, because you're doing the same thing in reverse. And all the time, I'm subliminally drawing on my direct experience. All the time, you're translating what I'm saying into your own experience, I hope. Of course, if you've lost me, what's happened is you're not able to do that. You've missed a step in the argument somewhere, or you've gone off somewhere, so you're not able to bring it back into your own experience. So that's fine, as long as you know what you're doing, as long as you're aware that what you're dealing with is concepts, abstractions, generalizations, which do not have any reality. They don't exist. This is not anything very sophisticated or complex. This is very basic. But what happens is we mistake our concepts and even our words for reality. And we start to think that when we're thinking about our concepts and abstractions, that we're producing something real, if you see what I mean. So we've got this experience of ending, which is a real experience. I come to the end of the room and I bump into the wall. It's an end, a terminus, a boundary, a finitus, an ending. So I then apply that, you know, useful abstraction from my experience of coming to the end to everything. And actually, even everything is a ridiculous overgeneralization, because you can never experience an everything, if you see what I mean. It's a notion that comes from our experience of dividing our experience up into discrete things and then thinking of the sum of all things. The sum of all things never exists, if you see what I mean. It only exists in thought. If you think otherwise, bring show. If you see what I mean. It's a sleight of thought. The world, or the universe, is no doubt in physics, cosmology, and so forth, is a defined term. But in general usage, it's the abstraction of abstractions of space and time. And when we start to speculate upon these abstractions, we end up with trouble. We'll come back to all this, I hope, but I hope you're with me so far. What the Buddha's saying is that these questions arise from a failure to really understand what you're doing when you're asking these questions, taking your thoughts too seriously, if you see what I mean. It's a bit like in some situations I've experienced saying something like, well, you know, everything is impermanent. And somebody will say, ah, yes, but what about impermanence? Do you see what I mean? You've taken an abstraction, a way of indicating something that when applied to experience is true. And you think of that thing, that abstraction, as itself a thing. And then that abstraction and its falsification in terms of a thing denies the term itself. It's very difficult to explain if people haven't got a reasonable degree of a sort of sophistication with concepts. So the Buddha is basically saying you can't think about things in these terms. Especially you cannot think about me after I'm dead in these terms. So in what terms can we think about the Buddha? In what terms can we think even about our experience? But what the Buddha is really indicating, is pointing to, is the fact that things are not as they seem to us to be. We've already constructed our experience in such a way that when we start to extrapolate from it, we end up with absurdity. But we've already accepted a sort of falsification. In a sense, you could say, simply to experience is to falsify. Because it seems to us, by the great German philosopher Schopenhauer called the original disposition of the mind, we're disposed to think that there is out there a real solid independent world that's independent of the moment of experience. That the moment of experience is a flash, a moment of seeing something that exists independently of the moment of experience. Huh? And similarly, the original disposition of the mind, the way in which experience is given to us, is prepackaged with the assumption that I am having the experience. There is an I who stands behind, independent of experience, having experience. So it's as if there's a world that is experience, but it exists independent of the experience. And there's an I that owns the experience and that exists independent of the moment of experience. That's natural. It's built in. And in a way, you could say it's extremely useful. It it makes it possible to experience. We need to assume, we need to interpret the external dimension of our experience in terms of a unity of object, if you see what I mean. It all needs to belong to a single unity, so that, you know, now my experience is related to now my experience. So that, because if all my experience was discrete, my experience of this room now would have no relation to my experience of this room now, if you see what I mean. I have to assume that there's some endurance of the object in space and time, independent of my experience of it. So when I turn my back, it's still there. I heard recently an anecdote about the English linguistic philosopher A.J. Ayer, that towards the end of his life he became rather eccentric, and he was caught on occasions trying to jump into empty rooms to see whether they were there when he wasn't. Needless to say, he failed. But it's in a way, it's an enterprise worth engaging in. I'm afraid it won't succeed, because you're unfortunately there whenever you get there when it wasn't there, if you see what I mean. But do you see what I mean? We naturally string our experience of the objective dimension together in a single moment of apperception. We assume that this moment objective experience relates to previous moments of objective experience, which all belong to a single stable universe, which is not entirely stable. It shifts and changes, but it changes in an orderly way, a predictable way, independent of my perceiving it. Of course, it works, doesn't it? Otherwise, how on earth did you get here? How on earth do I keep going, speaking right now? How on earth do you continue to listen? There must be an assumption of continuity in the object, independent of the experiencing moment. But notice the word assumption. It's an assumption, very useful, very effective for practical purposes, assumption. Similarly, I have to assume a unity of the observer, that each moment of experience is sort of united in a self that has those moments. Yeah? Are you with me so far? It's what's going on right now. We're all... we have a solid, natural sense that we are a unitary observer observing a unitary field, both of which exist independently of each other. What the Buddha's saying is that although that view is effective from certain points of view, for certain objectives, for the survival of the organism, even for communication of the Dhamma, it cannot be established in experience, if you see what I mean. You can never see, like A.J. Ayer jumping into the room, you can never see the objective field without you experiencing it. You can never verify it. In the same way, the Buddha argues that you can never discover you independent of the moment of experience. And there are many Buddhist practices, exercises, where you actually try to do that. You try to go looking for a self that exists independent of the moment of perception. And believe me, I've done it for 45 years. You can't do it. You can never find any element within or without that stands independent of the moment of experience. You just can't find it. You can think about this later. But the Buddha says that you can't find it. Later Buddhist tradition goes even further than this, and argues that, it really builds on what the Buddha himself said. It argues that what you actually experience is not reality. And perhaps one could approach this from a more common sense point of view, from the common sense sort of neurophysiology of it. We experience, light coming, bouncing off an object, entering the, my physiology is pretty ropey, through the lens and onto the retina at the back, and then going through the optic nerve and abracadabra. There is a room full of you. It's translated into an image, which is not a neurological signal. I don't experience a neurological signal. I don't experience light passing along the nerve. What I experience is an appearance, again, quoting the great Schopenhauer, a representation. It's not the thing itself. Is pretty radical. I don't want to press it home too far because you might not be able to get home. It's pretty radical. If you start to really examine your experience, you realize that what you're experiencing is not objects, but a mental construction, an image. It appears to be out there, but it can't be out there. Even on common sense bases, if you see what I mean. It may in some way be related to something out there, although even the notion of out there is part of the construction of out there. You see what I mean? But I can never experience what's out there, so to speak, independent of the process of a neurological and psychological perception. What happens as an image, as a representation, what I prefer to call an appearance. Phenomenon is, of course, simply means appearance. But why not use a good English word, an appearance? Everything appears. It's like that, of course, with the external world. I've used the sense of sight. It's the same with all the other senses. You can get very strong experiences of this with sound, I find. It's more difficult with sight because sight is a much more concrete mode of experiencing, if you see what I mean, and it much more quickly forms itself into a solid reality. With sound, you can hear a sound. And you're not quite, if you don't know what the sound is caused by, you can have a definite sense that it's neither out there nor in here. This is one of the great benefits of tinnitus. I don't recommend it for other bases, but on a long solitary retreat, I developed quite acute tinnitus. And in meditation, it's a very strange experience because it so definitely seems to be coming from somewhere. And yet you know it's not, but it presents itself again and again and again as coming from somewhere. And hearing aids are very interesting from this point of view. That's why I wear them. I'm not really deaf, but because what's happening is the sound waves are being translated through, a chip into an electromagnetically amplified sound, if you see what I mean. But it's even one more remote from the original sound than the original sound is from what it was originating. Very, very interesting in that way, when you begin to break it down. And a lot of a particularly more abstract art is interested in this sort of boundary between external and internal. a very strong experience with the modernist, minimalist music, Reich. I didn't really understand it, but a friend who knows these things took me and told me what to listen to. And you begin to experience sounds emerging between notes. You know, there'll be repeated patterns which are slightly off cycle, and they for a moment coincide and then they separate, and your ear interprets the separation in terms of a third sound that emerges between them. And it's a very odd sensation because it's palpable, audible, and yet you know it's not there. It's a very odd experience. And a lot of abstract painting, I think, is exploring this sort of boundary, and often defying your attempt to construct, leaving you hanging in interpretive space, if you see what I mean. So all our experience, all that we call our experience, is actually some sort of, we can say reconstruction, but of course even to say reconstruction is itself a reconstruction within the view of reconstruction. I'm getting so clever this time. Do you see what I mean? That your experience is already a reconstruction, and then on the basis of your reconstruction, you translate it into abstractions which reconstruct the reconstruction. That's what it is. And all our experience, in the end, is some kind of representation. Some kind, it's an appearance. And the Buddha says that if you take that appearance and start to take it completely literally, you get into trouble. Because you're accepting literally the externality of the objective dimension of the moment of experience, and you're taking literally the internality of the subjective element in the moment of experience, and you're fixing them and then starting to wave them around and hit yourself and everybody else on the head with theories built upon them. And whilst a degree of theorizing may be useful, it may create iPads and atom bombs and machines that make what do they call them? Smoothies. why did that represent it? They sort of work in terms of getting to a talk and understanding what's going on and so forth. They don't do for understanding what ultimately reality is. They lead us astray. And they have to be used and held in a provisional, as if, sort of way. It's a, let's look at it like this. It's all, you could say, a model that we construct. But the big question is, using the metaphor of reconstruct, using the metaphor of model, a model of what? this is the big question. I'm not going to deal with it today. I'll try and work out what the answer is and tell you tomorrow. But that's what the question that's begged, isn't it? Because if we try to understand our experience in terms of a representation, it sort of already suggests in the abstractions that we're using something that is represented. If we talk about reconstruction, something that's constructed, something that's fabricated. But what? This, of course, is part of where the Buddha is taking us when he refuses to answer the what are called the avyakrita, the unanswerable questions. But I want to look a little bit more at what this appearance is. We've looked at it, well, I've looked at it in terms of a representation that kind of naturally presents itself to us in terms of an independent objective reality and an independent subjective perceiver. It's the original disposition of the mind, the way it happens, the way we learn as babies to parse the world, to construct the world, is as something definitely in here experiencing something definitely out there, both of which are independent. And sub voce, under the breath, permanent and real, as abiding, as enduring. We think of the internal dimension of experience as existing independent of the moment of experience, and permanently so. So we think of experience happening to something that doesn't change. We think that the externals change to some extent, what philosophers call the accidents. You know, I'm definitely different to how I was 60 plus years ago. Well, I was going to say I have more hair. Had more hair then, but of course I didn't to begin with. But even if you trace the progress of my hair, you can see that all the accidents have changed hugely. They started with none, little fuzz, and I had lovely blonde curls when I was a little boy. I've got photos of me. Oh, so sweet. And then gradually it went sort of mousy, and then it went really long in the 60s, really dirty and tangled. And then it got shorter, and then it began mysteriously to disappear again as second childhood got closer and closer. I approached the physical form of it. So definitely, you know, I know when I look at that picture of that little boy standing there in such a characteristically subotine pose, but identifiably somehow connected with me. As if I know exactly what everything is and where it should be, even though tomorrow I'll think something different. And it should be the way I think it is. Stop, that's enough. But it's definitely a different sort of accident. But I think of that as being me. I think of that I somehow have remained all the way through. I don't think about it very much, but I somehow think that I've always been without really thinking about it, because I don't have any experience, like poor old Ayer in the darkened room. I don't have any experience of not being, because it's not an experience that you can have. And when I think of after death, it's not really easy. It's not possible to think of life after I'm not in it. Because even when I think of life and I'm not in it, I'm thinking of it as me experiencing life with not me in it. So that in the background, the inevitable background of my construction of my experience, my representation of my experience, is an assumption of an enduring me. And it's an enduring me that is independent of the moment of experience. It's somehow owns experience, it somehow has experience, but it's somehow unchanged by experience. Of course, we will say, oh, I've changed, and so forth. And we recognise that at a superficial level, or even quite a deep level, at a psychological and even maybe spiritual level. But somehow lurking at the back of it is an assumption of something unchanging. It's hard to catch. We also consider that self that we read into, we have to read into our experience in order to have the experience, Kant called it the transcendental unity of apperception, that outside the moment of experience, there's something transcendental in the sense of being outside the moment of experience, which has the experience as a unity. You see what I mean? That sees it as one. And that is a unity. The perceiver is a unity. We have to do that. And we think of that self that has experience, as sort of the generator of itself. The Buddhist term is author of itself, or self-created, existing from its own side, making itself, so to speak. So this is a necessary delusion, if you like, simply to have experience. And mutatis mutandis, changing that which needs to be changed, it applies to everything outside. We assume that it exists permanently, we assume that it exists independently, and we assume that it exists from its own side, and that somehow experience is the meeting of these two. But we cannot actually discover either the independent object or the independent subject. If we go into an inquiry, if we look closely at our experience, we cannot find either. And I invite you to do some homework on the way back. Be careful when you're crossing roads. Probably best to take the external reality of the road and the cars on it for granted for the time being, and the solidity of your own reality for granted. But just sort of start to investigate. Is what I've said true? Is there an assumption of an independent, unitary self, which is the author of itself? Is there an assumption of an independent, a unitary field of experience that is independent and self sort of generated, coming from its own side? Is that there? Can you find it? So interesting even just to ask, how would you find it if you wanted to find it? Well, we've only got limited tools. We've got senses and we've got reason, at least for the time being. We might find some more later. But just go looking. See what you can find in either of these cases. It'd be very interesting to see where we come to tomorrow. I haven't left time for questions, as usual. But I hope you've got a sort of an idea of the trajectory that we're on. We're trying to understand why the Buddha refused to answer these questions, and hopefully we'll come to not an answer to these questions, but to a more positive content for them, something that's more, I won't say intellectually satisfying, but spiritually satisfying, if you like. I hope you've understood why, at least I'm asserting, on behalf of the Buddha, why he couldn't answer those questions, because they're abstractions from experience that have no independent reality of their own. I hope you've understood that experience itself is already a construction. It's a construction which presents itself to you as an appearance. But that appearance, which presents itself to you as being an external and internal reality, is just an appearance. What it's an appearance of, we'll try and investigate tomorrow. We'll try and arrive at an intelligible understanding of what that reality may be, if there is such a reality, independent of the appearance. Maybe there isn't one. Maybe there is one. Let's try to find out tomorrow. And in the meantime, please, if you can, take moments when you're safe and reasonably quiet, and just look at what's happening and try to maybe just sort of think it's an appearance and try to see what that actually might mean. Investigate the suggestion that what you experience is appearance, not thing. What it is experiencing is an appearance, not a self. Just investigate that. And, sitting on the tube and just for a moment, just relax and sort of watch what's going on, what's happening. What is this experience? What is appearing? What does that appearance signify? What is the reality in that experience? And let's see where we go tomorrow. I hope that I'll begin to push a little bit beyond appearance, although it's impossible, but at least give us a sort of aesthetically and spiritually satisfying way of beginning to do so. And I'll try and leave some time for questions. I'm not very good at that. Somebody will have to show me a war, an ending, a finitude, and we'll take it from there.